I'm Dan, and among many other things, I am also a recovering drug addict and alcoholic. I've been doing this sobriety clean time shit since 1982. That makes me a little over 43 years sober and clean. And it's a pretty important thing in my life. I wouldn't be here today if it wasn't. I have no idea what I'm going to say, how long I'm going to talk. I actually forgot I was going to be doing this today until this morning. And I jumped up on the Tessnoa meeting, 8 o'clock a.m. It's always been 8 o'clock a.m. here on the East Coast of the United States. And damn, there was nobody there. And I'm like, fuck. What is going on here? And I thought my computer was messed up or something. Because I'm like, just no. I mean, they're like clockwork. They're always on time. So I ended up texting Jan, and she's like, oh no, dear, the time changed. And I'm like, well, that didn't have anything to do with it. And then she told me that, oh, they don't change time until the 30th. So I'm still so freaking Maricentric, and egocentric that I still think the fucking world revolves around me. The time changed, everyone else should have changed too. But thank you, Jan, for correcting me and letting me know that this meeting, actually, I had it on my calendar for 1 o'clock this afternoon. So it was good that Eastern time in the US. So it was good to touch bases with Jan and find the real time. So the last time I spoke or gave my lead at Tessnoa, I was in the midst of pretty severe depression. I was in the depths of it, and I cried pretty much through the whole damn thing. And I don't think I'm going to do that today, but I don't know. And there's some joy in tears, I'm not going to do a lot with AA, even though AA has been a big part of my life and recovery, because the thing I like about Tessnoa is that it's not AA. I mean, it's a free thinkers group, and this is one of the things I enjoy about it. I'm not a dogmatist, but I still like, people's ideas and thoughts. And I just finished a really wonderful little book called The Dictionary of Obscure Sorrows by a guy named John Koenig. He has a website that's available under the same name. And I found a word earlier this year called sonder, which I actually used as a topic for meeting topic a couple of weeks back when I chaired a secular AA meeting, not a Tessnoa meeting. So, but from the same book, I just there was something that it was the last, like close to the very end of the book. So I hope I don't spoil it for anyone. For Christ's sakes, it's a dictionary, How can you spoil that? But I loved this. When all is said and done, make your words real, even if you have to make them up as you go. If you have the courage to define yourself and take ownership over the terms by which you live your life, something mysterious will happen. The walls will fall away and the world will open up. And that is pretty much what happened to me when I got sober. I wouldn't say that I had a spiritual experience that they talked about in Alcoholics Anonymous, but it certainly was one of the things that happened to me, was that the scales fell off of my eyes and I got to see the world a little clearer for the first time in a long time. I grew up in a pretty dysfunctional family. I don't know if people are familiar with the ACEs, the which is about trauma, childhood trauma. And there's a screener for it. It's a 10 question screener, and I pegged a 10 on the screener, which is not a good score if you're, want to talk about trauma from my childhood. So I grew up in a pretty, dysfunctional family, but it was dysfunctional in at least, there was some fun in the dysfunction. And a lot of that fun was found in the use of drugs and alcohol. But my dad was a big drinker. My mom was a big drinker. They divorced when I was young. I grew up in, Janet said in Michigan. I did. I grew up in a little place called Edwardsburg, Michigan. And Elkhart, Indiana, and if you can see my hand, Michigan being the hand state, Indiana's right underneath it, and I live right here on the border. So, I don't know where the hell I'm going with that, but I grew up in a pretty dysfunctional family. I started they drank and smoked. I started smoking at like 5 years of age, stealing cigarette butts out of my mom and dad's ashtrays. Became a full-time smoker, smoking in front of, adults when I was 11. Was drinking. My dad used to put a shot of whiskey in our, little hot toddies. He would used to make hot toddies because my mom would go out once a week with the girls and, or to, a book study. That's not where she was really going, but that's what she told my dad. And anyway, he would make us hot toddies, a shot of whiskey and side a little tea and honey, and we would just go right to sleep. So he didn't have to really babysit us. I mean, he babysitted us with chemistry, I guess. I don't know. So, but he was the kind of guy that, and my family is the kind of family that, when they always were drinking, we could always take shots of, beer or whatever they were drinking, we could always drink it. They never held back. And my first real drunk was when I was 12 years old, and I had a blackout drunk when I drank, and I did some pretty crazy shit on that blackout drunk, and it was humiliating, and I wasn't humiliated. Because I can't explain it. I mean, only people who've been there know it. I don't know where I went during that blackout, but wherever I went, it's as it says in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it whatever it did, it rocketed me into a fourth dimension of existence I didn't even know was there. And I loved it. And so I began at 12 years of age to start drinking very destructively. I didn't think it was destructive at the time, but the purpose of drinking was no longer, just to steal a taste or two from adults' booze. The purpose was to get blackout drunk, to get shit-faced, totally stoned. And I did that pretty much for 10 years. I was a pretty regular user through high school. I supported my alcohol and drug abuse by dealing drugs in school. And back in the 70s, that was kind of common behavior, I guess. I was mature looking enough that I was able to buy booze when I was 16 in a 21 state. And was able to sell booze, little bottles of booze, to support my habit. And I worked two part-time jobs, so I was always in and had money and always had access to booze and drugs, and I used it a lot. I somehow managed to graduate from high school. I don't know how, but I did. And I put on a backpack and I hitchhiked down to Florida, and then I hitchhiked up to Atlanta, Georgia, and I stayed in Atlanta, Georgia for 3 years, from 77 until 80. In Atlanta, I found cocaine and crystal meth, and I also found the needle. And so I became an IV drug user at that time. And I found that drinking alone, I mean, I found it out early when I was about 14, 15, that drinking alone just wasn't enough to put you in a blackout, that you could get into blackout quicker when you mixed drinking with, barbiturates or with Valium or whatever. You mix those drugs with alcohol, you could get into blackout a lot quicker. And that's what I did. So when I moved to St. Louis, I was also still living in, a pretty much drug-induced coma, it seemed like. I was just, a walking zombie. And I just, I mean, I lived a life that was just about trying to stay in a perpetual state of annihilation. And that just was it. Most people have dreams and goals in life that they want to pursue. And by the time I was 22, I really had only one obsessive goal, that was to and it was a suicide plan, is all it was, but it was a righteous little suicide plan. And I was going to hitchhike out to California from Indiana here, and on my way out to California, I was going to lose all forms of identification. I was going to lose my driver's license, my library cards, because I love to read, and I have always been a reader, even during the pits of my drinking, the deep depths of my drinking and using. And I was going to lose my fingerprints. I figured I could just dip them in battery acid along the way at some truck stop. I was pretty good at getting into fights in bars. Being an atheist, I had a lot of fun whenever talking, politics and religion. Back then, I was a pretty right-wing, libertarian kind of guy who, a little bit farther to the right than not, than not anywhere near close to what is out there today. But I was a right winger. And I would get into fights with people, and I would be insulting. I like to use the N-word and homo and things like that. And those were words that could get you in a fight pretty quickly. So I was pretty bigoted. And I figured, hell, I'd just get my teeth knocked out of me when I was on my way out to California. And if I made it out to California, I was going to take a swan dive off one of those beautiful cliffs and just become part of the food chain. That's what my aspiration was at 22. That's all I could think about, and I was obsessed with it. And I was working for a car dealership, and I got fired because of my drinking, and went back to my mom's house, and got on the way home, I got a case of beer and drank that beer down pretty quickly, smoked a few joints, I think, and I passed out, and I came to, and I was out of beer, pissed me off. And I'm upstairs in my mom's house, and my two other brothers still lived with my mom. They were younger than me, and they still lived with mom. And my mom had a boyfriend who was an avid hunter, and he had a bunch of guns in his closet. And I just remember standing at the stairwell there in my mom's house, and I didn't have any booze, but I knew that there my mom had vodka and whiskey in her, liquor cabinet, which was locked, padlocked with the, old-fashioned hasp and lock on it, because yours truly drank her liquor as well. And I'm standing there at the top of the stairs, and all of a sudden I just hear these voices calling my name. And I realized it was the guns in the bedroom that were calling my name. And it was like a shock that I had. I don't know if it was a voice or what it was, but it was just a total realization that I was going to kill myself, and I would kill anybody who tried to stop me. And that just terrified the shit out of me. And I was confused. I didn't know what I was doing. I broke into my mom's liquor cabinet. I stole a huge shot of vodka that as much as I could drink in one shot. And I went running down into my little tiny bedroom. I passed out. And I came to later that night. My brother was home. I was shaking, trembling. And I asked him for a beer. He was not in a good mood, and he had no love toward me whatsoever. I was begging him for a beer, and he rightfully had no love lost toward me. I just beat the shit out of him a couple of nights earlier, or mornings earlier. Anyway, the long and short of it was, he gave me one beer. I told him, "I promise you this will be the last beer I ever drank." And I did not mean that I was going to get sober. I meant that I was going to go out to California. He said, "Sure." And I drank that beer and went back to bed. When I was younger, I had a real history of violence. I was a very violent child. I threw all of my brothers into the hospital with I cut off my older brother's thumb. I chipped a vertebrae in my younger brother's back, on my youngest brother's back, which he still reminds me of to this day. And I did black and blued my second youngest brother, and anyway, they had a nickname for me. They used to call me homicidal maniac, and that was a pretty apt description. So my mom sent me to see child psychiatrists, starting at about the age of 12, and I from the age of 12 to 17 or so, I was seeing psychiatrists. Never really did any good with it with me. I mean, I still was acting out and everything. I still had a lot of violent tendencies. But the last psychologist that I had was a guy named Mike Oyer, and for some reason, at our last visit, he told me if I ever had any problems, if I ever had any trouble, that Oaklawn, which is the facility I went and saw him at. He said, "Oaklawn opens up at 7 o'clock in the morning, and they'll see people free of charge. If you're ever in any trouble, you can always do that." Well, for some reason, I remembered that. And that next morning, on January 22nd, 1982, I went to Oaklawn at 7 o'clock in the morning, and went to a little foyer, and just, and I mean, it was freezing out. It was like 20 below zero that day. It was cold. But I got there, waited in that little foyer, and this guy came out. And for some reason, I heard him say, "Free man." And I thought he said, "You're a free man." And I don't, and that's not what he said. His name was Free Man. His Freeman Schrock is his name. And but I thought he said that I was a free man. And at this time, I don't know, that just resonated with me at the time. I ended up, doing an interview with him for about an hour or so. And he asked me how much I was drinking, which was like, I thought just, I never really ever heard that question before. And I told him I drank about a case of beer a day, about a pint of whiskey, and whatever else I can get my hands on. And of course, I did tell him about, the guns talking and, the plan to head out to California and all that. I figured for sure they were going to lock me up in our local psychiatric ward to Northwest. That's what I was hoping they were going to do. But they didn't. He told me, he goes, "You sound like me. You sound like you're an alcoholic." And he told me that if you really want help, there's only one place in the world to get it for people like us, and that's Alcoholics Anonymous. And he sent me to my first AA meeting on January 22nd, 1982. And so, like I said, it was blistering cold that day. I managed to get my car started and was able to drive to the location. I like where the location was. It was on the corner of Fifth and High. It's just, alcoholic sense of humor there. Fifth and High. And anyway, the there was a church parking lot across the street from the clubhouse, and I went to into the clubhouse because the meeting was supposed to start at 10 o'clock. Nobody was there at 10 o'clock, and I waited in the parking lot. And I don't know if you've ever done this before. I was smoking a cigarette, and I'm like, if nobody's here by the time I'm done with this cigarette, I'm out of here. And nobody was there, so I flipped my butt out the window and started heading out the driveway. And just as I'm heading onto the street, this big old Pontiac, blue Pontiac, pulls up, stops me, and this little lady jumps out and she's waving her arms in the air, and I can hear her yelling, "Are you here for the meeting?" And her name was Sarah, and she literally opened the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous for me. So, I was surprised. The meeting, they bust in a group of people from the local psychiatric wards, and other people showed up. The people looked pretty normal to me. They didn't look, like alcoholics to me. And but they, started talking, and they did the normal, Alcoholics Anonymous routine, starting the meeting with a prayer and all of that stuff. Then they read the how it works and the 12 steps, and they kept putting that God word out there. And I was an atheist, before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was a, Madeline Murray O'Hare, American Atheist Association atheist guy. I was an atheist, and I just didn't think that this thing was going to work for me. And after the meeting, I, started heading out, and this one guy named Bob Adams, he stopped me from across the room. He just yelled, "Newcomer," and I turned around and he said, "Do you have a copy of the Big Book?" And being the smart ass that I was, I said, "Yeah, I've got 21 copies of the Big Book," because I used to collect Bibles. Because it was one of my favorite arguments was whenever a person would say, "But the Bible says," I would say, "Which one?" I mean, there's only 200 and some odd translations in English of the Bible. I mean, it's like you have to be specific. Which Bible are you referencing? Because that does make a difference. But Bob was okay with that. And he said, no, not that book, the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he handed me a copy of it. And I told him, "I don't have the $3.65 to buy it." And he goes, "Don't worry." He goes, "I'm going to give it to you." And he did. And he told me something. He goes, "I believe that the answer you're looking for is in this book." And he goes, "And I think that once you find the answer, you'll pay back a thousand times over whatever I'm giving you today." I've bought a lot of big books for a lot of people, so I will say that. But I didn't find it, the answer. I found the answer pretty quickly, actually, in the big book. And it didn't come from the preface or any of that. It came from the doctor's opinion. And even though I disagree with the doctor's opinion today, and thankfully, I mean, it is the chapter is quite appropriately named the doctor's opinion. It's not the doctor's fact. It's just the doctor's opinion. But what struck me in that opinion was that alcohol was like an allergy. Alcoholism was like an allergy. And I still, even to this day, even though scientifically I know this probably is not true, I do know that experientially it is that when I pour booze into my system, it reacts differently with me than it does anybody else I know, other than other alcoholics. Because all I know is that when I pour it into my system, that craving develops. I want more. I want it till I black out. And I'm not going to stop until I get there. And that is unusual kind of behavior. So that was the hook. That's what brought me into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I told them I wasn't going to be able to do the God thing very well. They said, well, just try your best. And so I spent a lot of years trying my best. I did the fake it till you make it kind of thing. I never made it. But I did a lot of prayer. Yeah, a lot of, times on my knees, on my back, and all of that, trying to pray away all of my character defects and shit. And it just, didn't seem to work. What worked was that Alcoholics Anonymous kept me busy. It kept me in the fellowship doing something else than drinking. It kept me involved in doing something else other than thinking about myself. Because I, think about myself often. And the thing about community is that it allows you to think about someone other than yourself and how you might be of service and being able to be of help to someone else. And that's what AA, one of the things that AA did for me. Another thing that AA did for me was that it helped me develop a discipline of self-reflection. I mean, I think that the inventory taking stuff that is talked about in the big books and around the tables and everything is very important. And from time to time, because I still keep a daily journal. I write in it almost every day, but I don't write in it every day. But I try to write in it, is every day. So, I try, and I've been doing that for years. And I think that self-reflection and being able to see where different scenarios as I write about them, just life in general, gives me a better perspective how to be a better human being. Like the reading I started out with, it gives me a chance to play with all those words, because I love words. And it allows me to speak those words to myself and then to define myself. And then defining myself, my sobriety is like right at the very top of my definition. I would not be here without my sobriety. There is just absolutely no question in my mind about that. And how I got it really seems to me is an important part of the story. But like I said, I wasn't very co you know, wasn't very sure how I was going to address this talk or not, but sobriety to me is important. I've got some friends that sobered up in AA. They're back out, they're using, and when I say they're using, I'm not saying that they're using destructively. I mean they've turned back into normal drinking kind of people. I'm not like that. I mean, I just, I'm not going to experiment with it. I experimented it with it, I guess, in a way with smoking, because like I said, I started smoking at a young age, and I off and on with cigarettes for many, many, many years. And so back in 2013, I quit smoking for the last time, and I haven't had a cigarette since then. But the thousands of times I tried quitting, before my final quit, I always told myself the same lines that I think, other addicts tell themselves. I can just smoke one. One ain't gonna kill me. I can just do the one. And that's, the first one's the one that always got me. So I just had to make my mind up that no matter what, I was not going to smoke a cigarette. I had to kind of apply the same thing that I had done with my drinking and drug use to my cigarette smoking, and it finally took hold, 12 years ago. But anyway, what I'm doing now, I am still I'm like I said, 3 years ago I was in a pretty bad depression. A year later, my ex-wife divorced me. We had been married 20 years. I thought we were going to be together for, the rest of our days. We're not. We divorced. And I was pretty shocked by, just the suddenness of the divorce. She unilaterally said I wanted a divorce, and that was it. It was over. And, but that got me, into taking care of myself, and so I've been doing a lot more of that, taking care of myself. And one of the things I did, even though I had spent years in therapy for my depression, I had been on antidepressants for a number of years. I was, bottoming out again in this depression. I turned to yet another treatment for the depression, which was transcranial magnetic stimulation, TMS. I did that over a year ago, and that was a treatment that really helped me. And so for the last year, I've been relatively depression symptom free. In fact, I've even have gone off all of my antidepressants. I have not had an antidepressant now for about 3 months. So that, and that was a goal of mine, was to be, off the antidepressants. So, happily, I can say that I'm not feeling depressed. All of the other symptoms along with the depression have seemed to really have lifted. So, and that's good because I live a pretty active life. I mean, I'm still involved with the recovery community, which I consider my home community. I'm involved, very involved politically here in the States. I went from the radical right to the woke left. I'm definitely DEI. I'm writing a poem about DEI, about I'm diverse, equitable, and inclusive. And I don't know, I can't just, I'm trying to find the inspiration is somewhere there, but I am totally DEI. And I'm, very involved in fighting back against this tyrannical fascist, what I, clearly, and I'm speaking academically here, the fascist government that is aligning itself with other authoritarian and fascist governments across the world. It's not a pretty picture. And I'm an active resistor to that, and will be, and will, and if I have to die doing that, I've resolved myself to that as well. But I'm having fun doing it. There is a certain joy that I find in resisting authoritarianism And so tomorrow when I'm out on that picket line with the postal workers, I'll remember that in that nearly freezing temperatures tomorrow up here in Indiana, that I'm here because it's also a joyful thing. But there's community in there too, and so I don't know what the hell anyone's gonna get out of this. I'm done talking. I probably won't go back to the recording and hear myself. It's just, it is what it is right now. So, but some of you, I've seen some of you at other meetings. It's good to see you here today. Thank you for showing up. I know that I've met a couple of you at the last Secular AA International Conference down in Orlando. I hope I get to live another year or two to meet some of you in Phoenix, because I'm definitely going to go to Phoenix, and I hope that some of you will be able to get there too, because it's a good time to be with people who share many of the same things. So that I just feel so much more relaxed at meetings like Tessnoa than I do at traditional AA meetings. I'm part of your clan, and so far you've never asked me to leave. You've never kicked me out. But I've never done anything that I would hope that it would ever kick my ass out either. So anyway, I think that you were saying something, Jan, about you know what I mean? I say so a lot. The fucking quilter or something. All right. I'm done. That's good to see you all here. I'm gonna shut up.